Hi everyone, this is Evan Murray. This is Music Industry Insights. You can reach me at evan@musicindustryins.net. There is a three-part series in Taiwan. This one here is with my friend, and his name is Joe Henley. Joe is a Canadian, but he's been living in Taiwan for 17 years now. He's the lead singer of a death metal band, and he's also a published author, both in English and in the Mandarin language. Joe is a journalist. Joe has written his own books. You know, he has one now that's called Migrant, and it's about the struggle of the migrant workers in Taiwan. He makes a fictional story about a guy from the Philippines who tries to make his way in Taiwan. Story is a lot about how migrant workers struggle in Taiwan. It's a sad situation. You know, I've been living on and off in Taiwan for 3 years. It's a sad situation with the migrant workers here, but, you know, where they're coming from is much worse. I think we all have to keep that in mind when we talk about that, or if you are to research it. But anyways, so Joe, you know, he's a super nice guy. He advocates for justice amongst people, equality. And he's also in a super interesting death metal band. The death metal band actually propagates Buddhism. And this conversation is like all about that. And so you're going to learn all about, you know, the Buddhist aspects. You're going to learn more about what Joe has done in his writing career. You're going to learn more about the music scene, the indie music scene in Taiwan. Now, of course, people say, well, why didn't you talk to an indigenous Taiwanese person or, you know, someone that, you know, is from there? But I did. Like, I did an interview with a famous artist named Kimberly, and I did an interview with a lady who is one of the, head consultants for the Golden Melody Awards. It doesn't really get more Taiwanese than that. But when talking about the indie scene, it was super easy to talk to Joe because Joe speaks perfect English. And also Joe's got a really good grasp on things. Like I said, like he's a journalist. He works alongside and he does projects for the export company here called Taiwan Beats. Like he'll take on, you know, he had an article in the Taiwan Times actually, or Taipei Times, where he was a music journalist. So talking to this guy is like, I don't care where you're from. If you want to kind of know what the indie scene is all about in Taiwan, Joe's a great guy to talk about, you know, talk about that with. But anyways, I don't want to hold this up anymore. So this is my interview with Joe Henley, the lead singer of Dharma. Take what you can out of it. Enjoy it. And I'll check you later.
I'd like to welcome my guest here, Joe. How you doing? Nice to see you.
Hey, great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, right on, man. Can you just give us a rundown? Introduce yourself, please, and start from wherever you want and end wherever you think.
Hey, my name is Joe. I've been in Taiwan for about 16 years. I kind of came out here on a whim because my old roommate in college just said Taiwan is fun. I said, okay, I like fun. And 3 weeks after she told me that, I was here. Washed up in Taipei, and I make my living as a writer, a freelance writer for print and television and online media. But then on the side, I'm screaming my head off in some death metal bands, which I've been doing for about the past 15 years. So it's been a while. I've seen a lot in the music industry here and gone to do some touring around Asia, and it's been a lot of fun. And I'm still doing it to this day.
Right on. So yeah, I mean, like I came across, like, you know, me being in Taiwan, I came across you actually because sometimes I do some work with one of the government funded organizations here called Taiwan Beats. And I saw that you were doing some freelance writing. I asked Brian about you. I said, oh, who's this Joe guy? And he's like, hey, Joe's a great guy. He's like fully in, like living in Taiwan. He's in the music scene. He writes books. He does work for us. Like, let's talk about your journalist side for a little bit. So you, not only are you published book, like we'll go into the books in a second too, but you've written for the New York Times, right? Like, I mean, you've written for some fairly
not the New York Times, but the Taipei Times.
Okay, right. Okay, sorry. So you were a journalist in the Taipei Times. Tell me about that, please.
Yeah, I was when I first started freelancing full time about 9 years ago. An opportunity came up to do a music column for the Taipei Times, just documenting like the underground scene, talking about shows that were coming up, getting bands some wider exposure, because a lot of bands from here, they'd never been covered in English before. They'd been covered maybe in Mandarin or in some other languages, but they've never been kind of promoted in the West. So I wanted to use that opportunity to give some exposure to some of like the punk bands and the metal bands here that nobody really talks about outside of Taiwan. So I did that column for a few years until the budget ran out, unfortunately, at the Taipei Times. And they had to 86 that along with a bunch of other entertainment coverage. But yeah, for a few years, I got to call myself a music columnist.
So where does this start from? Like, where does it stem from? Like, you're a music, like, okay, so where did your love for music come from? Where did your love for journalism or writing stories come from? Is this associated? Tell me about a little bit about the start of that.
Okay, I'll start with the writing. I mean, ever since I was a really little kid, I just love to write. I'm not sure why. It's just kind of ingrained in my personality. Like, I was the kid in like grade two where if the teacher said, okay, write me a 2-page story, I'd come back with 20 pages. Like the okay. First
one of those, the first guys.
Story. Yeah. Well, the first, I remember like the first story, like the first like creative writing assignment that I ever had to do, I remember was like grade two. And the teacher just said, write a story. And I just ripped off the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie completely and basically just wrote that. I just kind of wrote out the entire movie by hand and handed that in. And I guess she probably should have given me a 0 for plagiarism, but she just kind of encouraged me and said, yeah, you're a writer. And I said, okay, that's what I am.
Okay.
I just never questioned that. And I've just been doing that ever since. And music, again, ever since I was little, like, you know, I'd be riding in my dad's truck, you know, and he'd be listening to Led Zeppelin, and I'd be like, well, I don't know what this is, but it's loud and it's fun. And, you know, my dad's dancing while he's driving, and I'm just having a great time there in the passenger seat, maybe 5 years old. And it just kind of instilled in me like a love for music and a love for just kind of like just having a good time, really. Like, I just always associated it with having fun, with rebellion, with especially with underground music. It's kind of like having a little secret. It's like being a part of a secret society almost. So it's a way to differentiate yourself from the pack a little bit. And I've just kind of held on to that. In a lot of ways, I've never grown up. Like, I'm 38 years old and I still feel the same way about music and writing that I did when I was 5. I don't necessarily see that as a problem. Other people might, but not me.
All right. So I'm going to touch on more of your writing career here, because I think it's kind of fascinating that you're in the two, you know, simultaneously in both, you know, both worlds in the arts and, you know, capitalizing and doing quite well in both, you know, so congratulations to you, first of all. Tell me about writing your first book. Like, what happened there?
With the first book, this is going back to 2012, and the way things work in Taiwan as far as like living and working here is that when you first get here, like if you want to stay, you got to have a visa. And for most people, that either means you're going to be a student or you're going to have a job. So I got a job in the publishing industry, working just as an editor / writer, putting out educational magazines and things like that. And in order to get permanent residence here and then have a visa that's not tied to an employer, so the employer just kind of controls you and owns you, basically, you just got to hold on to that job and that visa for 5 years. So that's what I did. I just held that job, saved up some cash, just kept my head down, worked. And then when the 5 years were up, I quit because I wanted to work on my own and I wanted to be independent. So I just said, you know what, I'm going to go freelance. And then when I did that, quit the job, got my permanent residence here so I could do whatever I wanted. And I just took a few months off and just wrote the first book, because at that time I was about 30. And I thought, okay, I'm 30 years old. I always said I was going to write a book, but I haven't done it yet. So if I'm going to do it, the time is now. So I took those few months off, just wrote the book, edited the book, and took some time, more time. Took me like 2 years to find a publisher. And so it didn't come out till like 2014, but that's what got me started writing books.
So you had a dream, like this was a dream, something that you held on to for a while. You know, like kids have, like, say, if you're a musician, you have a dream of playing stadiums or being famous or whatever, but you had a dream about also being an author. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Like it's something I always wanted to do. Like with music, when I was a kid, all I wanted to do was play one show. I just wanted to know what that felt like. Like I was a really nerdy kid. I had very, very low self-esteem. I was the kid that was always getting picked on. So I just thought, you know what? I'm never going to be in a band. If I get up on stage, people are just going to laugh at me. They're going to make fun of me. So I always just had this dream. Like, I wonder what it feels like to get up on stage, play some music, and just have people cheer for you. But I always just thought that would be a dream. And then when I came to Taiwan, I thought, okay, like I'm 12,000 kilometers from home. Nobody that I've ever known or who has ever known me is here. So let's try and make this music thing happen. If I fall flat on my face, you know, so be it. And that's how music got started for me here. And that was the start of my dream. Like the first show I ever played in my life in front of a crowd was here in Taipei.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't know that. And so did you travel through like a bunch of different scenes? I mean, we're going to end up, you know, we're traveling down this little road that you've created. You know, I'm kind of just trying to follow your path here up until we get to Dharma, which is your present band. So you know, you're working here, you got your permanent residency, you got, you know, you're establishing a life here, and it's because like you just find the atmosphere better, you're restarting your life, you feel freedom, you know, you can, let's say you can be yourself or the new version of yourself, let's say. So that sounds all liberating, of course. It sounds like it's a, you know, probably something everyone should try once in their life. What happens with now you're entering the music scene? Tell me a little bit about that. Like, let's just take your experience in the music scene from then till now, and let's just stop there before we really start talking about the band.
Okay. Like you say, like when I first came out here, like I started going to shows right away because I wanted to meet musicians and, you know, try and put a band together and see what I could get going. And it was really invigorating and liberating because at that time, like around, it was about like say 2005 when I first got out here, the metal scene was actually quite new. Like the metal scene, extreme metal, had only really gotten started like in the mid 90s here. So it's at least a decade behind the rest of the world. Wow. So you didn't really have like, you know, the infighting or the little gripes or the beefs between bands yet. It was still very, you know, all for one and one for all. It was just one scene. You didn't have, you know, different people didn't kind of get sucked into these sub scenes. Like, okay, we're in the thrash metal scene, we're in the death metal scene, the black metal scene, the punk scene. It was all kind of just one scene. It's just like we like loud,
because heavy, it was evolving, let's say, right? Like it was something that it was like a cultural, it was stirring the culture. Is that fair to say that?
Yeah, it was like very, it was in its like embryonic stage, I guess. We could got to be there to kind of witness that and be a part of it. So
sounds insane. Yeah.
Just the, yeah, and I mean the camaraderie of it, and like at that time, like for foreign bands, like bands from Europe or the States, Taiwan was still basically completely off the map. Like I went to like, I think it was the second show by a foreign metal band in Taipei, extreme metal, like ever. It was a band from Finland called Norther. And I think before that, Dark Funeral from Sweden had been here, and that was it at that time.
Wow.
So still completely off the map, still totally new, this kind of, you know, untouched gem, you know, as people, that old trope that people throw around in travel writing. So it was like a very, yeah, like you say, like invigorating, liberating time. It was something really exciting to be a part of.
And so what did you start out with first? Like when you first started your band, was Dharma the first one, or did you have other bands leading up to Dharma?
No, the first band was a death metal band. the drummer in that band was Jack, who I'm in Dharma with right now as well. But 2006, I went to a festival here in Taipei called Formos, and this guitar player I met there, his name was Charlie Lee. He just picked me out of the crowd because I had, you know, hair down to my ass and I had a big beard and I looked like a death metal guy. And just based on appearance alone, he walked up to me and he says, you know, you look like a metal guy. And I said, hell yeah. And he says, well, you know, my band, we just lost our singer. He just quit. So why don't you want to learn these songs and come audition in a couple weeks? And at that point, like I say, like I'd never been in a real band. I had tried to start bands back home in Saskatoon, but it just never happened. I'd never been in a band. I'd never actually, you know, been a growler seriously in a death metal band before, but he said, just learn these songs, come audition. And I said, sure. So I took the songs home, practiced screaming them in my apartment, which I'm sure my neighbors loved at the time. And then I'm pretty sure I was the only person who auditioned for the band. I don't think there was a lot of competition. So I just went in there, did the audition, and they said, okay, job's yours. And we did that band for over 10 years and toured around Asia, went over to Europe a little bit, and that was the start.
Now, were you a death metal fan previous? I mean, yeah, you looked like a metal fan, but let's say, you know, like I had super long hair and a big beard at one point in my life, but I mean, I knew about the band Gorgoroth, but that was my extent in death metal. I didn't really know about, or black metal or whatever. I didn't really associate myself, let's say. Maybe it was like stereotypical how I looked, but I was, were you a big fan of death metal before you were in a death metal band?
Oh, massive, massive fan. And I thought that's what all I would ever be. But yeah, since wow, my like
okay.
early to mid teens, yeah, I was a fan. Like Cannibal Corpse was where I started in death metal. And I started with punk when I was younger, but then I just kept looking for like heavier, faster stuff. I started picking up magazines. And I just saw the name Cannibal Corpse. And I'm like, I don't know what that is, but I'm going down to HMV tomorrow and I'm going to find something, you know?
Right.
And I went into the store and I saw the cover of a Cannibal Corpse album. And I'm like, okay, I don't know. That's like super hardcore. I don't know if I'm ready for that. And I think I had to go back to the store maybe three or four times before I actually had the nerve to actually take it up to the cash register. It was like buying porn for the first time. It's like, I was like, I'm not sure if I'm ready for this, but okay, here we go.
And I mean, that's so funny because people won't even know what buying porn is like anymore. You know, it's
just... Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I just completely dated myself. They're like, buying porn. Why would you do that? Like, why would you ever do that?
So, okay. So yeah, that's so interesting. It almost sounds, you know, like it does, man. It sounds a little bit like fate. You know what I mean? Like you're in a crowd, someone sees you. This is what you wanted. This is what you're doing now. It's starting to happen for you. So that band, how many years were you in that band? You did tour. You were internationally touring in that band. How many years were you plugging away at that?
That was about 10 years. And I mean, we never actually formally ended the band. We did about 10 years of like actively playing shows. And, you know, we actually got to open for Cannibal Corpse when they came here.
Wow.
In like 20.
There's another. 2013. Yeah. That's fate.
In like 2013, you know, and I'm, you know, hanging out backstage with this band that was, you know, completely formative for me. But then as happens when people get older, people started, you know, having kids and getting serious with careers. And so that kind of took its toll. A few guys had to take a step back. And so I guess I'll say like the band's on indefinite hiatus, but there was about 10 years where we were steadily plugging away.
Okay. So is that the only band you've had here besides Dharma then? I just want to kind of clarify like a little bit of your music career. So you were a fan, you were networking, you got spotted at a festival. This, you know, got you inside of what you were looking for, what you were doing. And then the other thing is you had success doing it. Do you contribute any of this success to your band to the fact that you are a writer, like that you can contact people, you can tell people that you're a writer? Like, does your writing prowess give you any advantage, let's say, of what, you know, of towards marketing yourself or towards getting publication for yourself?
I think it gave me a little bit of an edge just as far as communicating with people overseas. Like, I was able to sell the band, I think, to promoters and to other bands. Like, I would contact and say, hey, like, we're looking to tour in your country. Do you want to do set something up together? And so we would...
Like, the knowledge you had, like, wordsmithing, like, you could really... You could communicate in a very... You could articulate yourself in a very clear way, is what you're saying.
Yeah, you know, I could just tell them exactly what we wanted to do and let them know, you know, what's in it for them, what's in it for us, how we can help each other. Because, I mean, that's at the level that we were at, which was very, very underground.
Yeah.
It was basically just people helping people. It wasn't so much a business, like nobody was really making money. Like if you broke even, that was awesome. But it was mostly just bands helping each other. Like, okay, I contact, for example, a band called Defiled in Japan, who are great friends of ours. They set up a Japanese tour for us.
Okay.
If they want to come over to Taiwan, I set up the tour for them. We all do it all together. They sleep on our couches. We sleep on their couches. That sort of thing.
It's a really friendly thing, and it's a community thing. Like, you're really kind of working off of each other's goodwill for each other, kind of deal.
It was completely based on mutual love of the music and friendship. It wasn't really like a business thing.
Right. Having good experiences together and kind of, you know, living it kind of thing. Now,
So
Dharma, let's start touching on Dharma now. How did that, so you're in this band, you're doing cool things, you're traveling, you're doing this stuff, you're writing books. How many books have you got published at this point, by the way?
To date, I have three that are out there. Was the first one was kind of a political / murder mystery. The second one was kind of about the punk scene here. It was set in the punk scene, and the third one was about Southeast Asian migrant workers in Taiwan. But after Revilement, I had a couple of interim bands. I had a grindcore band called Stench of Lust, also with Jack, the drummer. So we've now been in three bands together.
Okay.
I had a horror punk band called Sledge City Slashers with some friends. We played like four shows, and then the guitar player and main songwriter, he moved back to Vancouver. That was the end of that. And then Dharma came about completely because of Jack. Actually, going back to when we were in Revilement, he wanted to bring in Buddhist themes into that band, and I was open to it because I was pretty much down for whatever at that point. I'm just like, okay, I'm in a band. I'm not going to question anything or like rock the boat. If somebody wants to do something, cool, let's just try it. And he actually, the other guys in the band weren't so much into it. They thought it was kind of weird. They just wanted to do like the blood and guts death metal type thing, which I was also fine with, but they let him do one... They let him do one Buddhist themed song, and that was kind of their concession to him. But after that, they're like, no, we're not doing this.
Because if you were to have a Christian death metal band in the West, you might think, oh man, that's kind of lame. So maybe like, people are all Buddhist here, maybe people think like, oh that, man, that might be kind of lame or disrespectful or something like that. You know? But I mean, to a Western person, it's like, what? Like, Buddhist death metal, it sounds so deadly, you know? It's like it sounds a lot more exciting coming from a Western perspective. So, yeah, please continue.
Yeah, so, you know, he's basically been wanting to do this band for like 15 years, but he's been struggling to find people, I think probably because of what you just mentioned. Like, if he says Buddhist death metal to somebody here, they think it's going to be like the old ladies they see at the temple chanting and... You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
they're total. And then they're just like, no, like I'm not really down with that. But
it's so funny. He was able about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Like he was able to convince our guitar player, Andy Lin. He had also been in a death metal band called Demise with him before. And he was kind of working on him a little bit and like introducing him slowly to the concept and what he wanted to do. And like the way that he was explaining it to all of us, he was like, well, in Buddhism, like in Buddhist lore, there's a lot of different tales or myths or legends or whatever you want to call it of Buddhas or Bodhisattvas transforming themselves into something evil in order to combat evil. Like, there's a precept in Buddhism which says that if, in order to combat evil, you must do evil yourself on a temporary basis, then that is permissible. So he wanted to write songs that were kind of based on that concept. Like, when we're on stage, we're transforming ourselves into something evil in order to save people from their cycle of karma and to release them from that. And so that kind of brought people around. He got Andy on board. They started writing songs together. They demoed some stuff, and then he sent it to me. And I just loved the music. And he just asked, you know, do you want to do vocals for it? And I said, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I definitely want in. So that was the start of my journey in the band. That started in 2018.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, like, I do have some, you know, I do have some religious studies under my belt. And I mean, I don't know about it, but I know that Buddhism is very diverse in its, say, religious aspect, you know, that there's many sects of it. I know that it was originated in India, and China and India did a lot of trading for, like, you know, hundreds of years in the development of it, right? And then it, from there, it broke even further into, like, Southeast Asia. And of course, and Taiwan has a really unique, I mean, I think this is really noteworthy just to mention that Taiwan has a super unique regional religion here that doesn't really exist anywhere else, where they're, I mean, yes, they have Buddhism, that's Buddhism, and then they have their Taoism, and then they have their regional religion, which is like a total mixture of, like, you know, warlords and Buddhist and Taoist philosophies, and it's really interesting. And all of the, it seems like this is not really separated either. It's kind of like these people intersect as well. Like, they're not like Christian Muslim, and they, you know, they're like, get away from me. They kind of intersect inside of their dogma, I guess, for lack of a better word. But when we talk about this, when you guys talk about, say, like what type of Buddhism are you following? If you are following a specific type of Buddhism, or is this like a generalized part of like Dharma is obviously, like, it has to do with, like, let's just actually talk about the word Dharma for a second. Like, tell me your version of that.
Well, yeah, Dharma, for the people who don't know, Dharma just means the way. It's the way you're supposed to live your life according to the different tenets of Buddhism. And we follow the Mahayana version of Buddhism, which is what the majority of people in Taiwan adhere to. But like you say, like, it's not all that dogmatic per se. Like, here they tend to mix Buddhism and Taoism freely. Like, you can go to temples here and there'll be Buddhist deities alongside Taoist gods, for example. And we kind of take that same open-ended approach to the band. Like, we're not out there preaching to people per se. We're presenting the culture of Buddhism. Like, we for people that haven't heard our music, which is probably most people, our songs are just these different Buddhist sutras and mantras that exist as they have for many, many centuries. We're just taking them and setting them to these death metal songs that we write. So it's repetitive. It's meant to, like I say, through the ferocity of the music, it's meant to release people from their cycle of karma, release them from the tension in their lives, the same way that just doing the chanting and repeating the mantras as Buddhist practitioners would do in their own personal lives, or as they would do at a temple when they want to pray for something. We're just doing that on stage and kind of taking the audience along with us.
Come on, man. That's so awesome. Really, like, such a... Like, that's such, it's such a, I mean, it's just so interesting. Number one, it's just interesting. I mean, I just kind of my language has just disappeared for me, because it's just, it's so interesting, but it's also so it's provoking all kinds of thoughts as well. And I can't really just get my head on it, because I mean, this is a, I mean, this is something big. Like, you guys even have monks in the band. Like, you have authentic, real monks in the band itself.
Yeah, we have a nun actually in the band.
A Buddhist nun in the band.
Yeah. She's on backing chants, and she actually performs solo between some of our songs, doing like intros, and she does a little piece at the beginning and the end of the show. The beginning of the show, she does something which is like a blessing for the show, and then at the end, she does something which is actually a traditional prayer for the dead, to bless the souls of the dead, to wish them peace, and to wish them a safe journey into the afterlife. And originally, we had a Buddhist master who was also my teacher, who guided me when I was first in the process of exploring Buddhism, and eventually took me through the ceremony to actually convert to Buddhism formally. Her name was Master Song, and she was actually in her 70s, and she did our first show with us. We opened for a satanic black metal band from Sweden called Marduk, and we billed the show as Buddha versus Satan, and I think we found that a lot more funny than Marduk did. We did it totally tongue in cheek, and I don't think they got the joke, but that's okay. She did the first show with us, and then unfortunately she suffered some health issues, and she was unable to keep performing with us. But she was the one who initially guided us and through this, because before we ever performed live, like, we wanted to make sure actually that we're not going to offend people.
Yeah, let's talk about that. That's where I was going next after I kind of gathered some information from you. Like, I mean, the implications of having a death metal band singing prayers kind of seems, you know, backwards until you find out that you guys are shouting out the devil, or shouting out casting the evil spirits kind of thing. I mean, it's actually fucking noble. You know what I mean? Like, there's actually like this noble, and that's what makes it so fucking cool, I think, is that it is noble, and it is, you guys aren't, let's say you're not saying, hey, like, you know, come and, you know, you're not trying to amass a cult, but even though you're a band, so you are in a type of way, but you're not, you know, the thing is, like, it's also about enjoying music. It's about enjoying an experience and also doing something good for people. So I just think it's ultra fucking interesting. Now, you must have offended somebody. Somebody must have been like, what are you talking about? I don't want to understand you. You know, I don't want to hear about this. Shut the front door. Tell me about the experience of did you go and canvas people? How did you get people not showing up at your shows and protesting, or how dare you offend us? Like, tell me about that.
Well, what Jack did before we ever did anything live, before we ever had any shows booked or anything, is he took the demo songs that we had recorded, and he just went around to various kind of Buddhist associations to talk to the higher ups, like Buddhist scholars, monks, nuns, and he just presented it to them. He said, look, this is what we want to do. This is why we want to do it. He presented all the concepts.
Oh my God. I don't mean to interrupt you, but so your drummer actually went and canvassed like religious people, or he went and canvassed the people in these, who is it? Like, is it a priest? Is it like, you know, in Catholicism or Christianity, there's a priest of a church. How does it work in Buddhism? Is there like a monks of a temple? Like, how does that work?
Well, the way that it would just translate into English is he basically just consulted the masters, the people who are heading up these. There's some like pretty massive like Buddhist associations here who they run the temples. They run the arms of these associations that do a lot of charity work in the community. And he went to them and he talked to the masters there, just presenting exactly what we want to do, the concept behind the band. And then he played them the music. And basically all of them just said, yeah, this is great. I mean, they actually really liked it. And even at our first show, we had like some people from these associations, like monks and nuns, actually show up at the show. So, I mean, they went for it. They said it was okay because, again, like, our goal was not to offend people. We weren't looking to, you know, challenge Buddhism or upend it or, you know, turn it on its ear or anything like that. We were just looking to present the culture as it is, just in this kind of new way. And I think they went for it for a couple of reasons. One, it's kind of new, and I guess they're kind of looking at it as a way to promote Buddhism to younger people.
Well, hell yeah.
And again, our purpose is not to convert people or to tell people that you should be a Buddhist. We're not about that. We're not about indoctrinating people in any sort of way. But in that same token, we didn't want to offend the establishment if we could avoid it.
Let's touch about this for a second. Like, I mean, this was meaningful to you to the point, like, you weren't a Buddhist before and now you are. Right. Yeah. So, like, I mean, that's kind of significant. And that's not kind of significant. I mean, that's really significant. So, and I know you're not trying to convert people, but you found it to be a better idea. And can we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. This, like, ever since I came to Taiwan, like, starting with when I joined my first band, like, I kind of just started following the path that was in front of me. It doesn't mean that I said yes to absolutely everything, but if something came across my path and I believed it was leading me in a positive direction, in a way that was good for my life personally or professionally, I just said, okay, I'd rather say yes than say no. So when this band first came around, it was a period of relatively high stress for me. Like, my profession is very high stress because I'm always having to scramble and look for work. I'm always under deadlines. I'm always having to fight to get paid on time by publications and chasing down money, that sort of thing. And it was kind of messing with me, like, personally and professionally. And I needed basically to calm down. I needed to find a way to, like, channel my thoughts, to kind of quiet my mind and just kind of become more peaceful. And that's when Jack introduced this band to me. It kind of just seemed like fate. And I wasn't entirely convinced at that time that, okay, like, I'm going to join this band and I'm going to become Buddhist. But as I studied it more, I studied for about 4 months, going to classes with this Master Song that I mentioned. And she taught me all about meditation and focus and the various mantras and sutras that we were performing as a band. And then she offered to me, and there was no pressure or anything. She said, look, like, you don't have to be Buddhist to be in this band. We're not going to be offended if you're not. Because actually not everybody in the band is Buddhist. We have Taoist guys, we have Buddhist guys, and all sorts of things. But when she said that, I thought, well, no, if I'm going to do this, let's do this all the way. Let's do this right. And so I decided to formally convert. Not that I was ultra religious before. I guess I was born Christian and I was baptized, but we weren't a religious family. We stopped going to church when I was about 5. And that was basically the end of that. But I thought, okay, no, let's explore this. Let's take this as far as I can go.
You know, it's really interesting. I mean, for a couple of reasons, well, for a thousand reasons, but, you know, because the thing is, I guess people need to realize too, is like, Buddhism just isn't a religion. It's also it's a philosophy more than anything about inner peace or outer, you know, inner and outer peace, I guess, and harmony with the world kind of thing. Like, it's not, I mean, that's what makes Eastern religion so different, radically different than Western religions. It's not like there's so much more philosophy in it, I guess. And I mean, I guess the thing is about Buddhism, it's like, it's a really in-depth analytical, you know, analytical, like, it's almost like a psychotherapy about life in a sort of way. So when we're dealing with this now, like, what, you know, like, so you're getting, I mean, this Jack guy sounds like a pretty serious character too, because I mean, like, he's pretty in-depth serious. Like, so what was the motivation there? Was he just like, hey, this will be a really good marketing idea? Or is he like a really devout Buddhist that, like, wants to bring world peace? Like, what's his motive? Like, I mean, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to ask you to speak for him, but like, what is the, like, it's a good, like, put it this way. If I'm a marketing guy, you guys have a great fucking idea, right? Like, that's the way I'm looking right at it anyways. Like, yeah, I'm like, yeah, let's roll with that idea. That's fucking cool. People think that's fucking cool. Let's go with that. Even if I don't care about Buddhism, you know what I mean? So tell me a little bit about the inside of that. Like, is this Jack guy, or you know, when he talked to you, like, you had a nun consulting you. Like, let's just get to the point, right? Like, that's pretty, you're joining a band and you understand the concepts, and there's like a master or like a heavy figure of the religion, like literally consulting you about your position in the band. This doesn't sound like a bunch of guys sitting in a garage drinking beer together. You know what I mean? so there's, I mean, this, like, come on, man, this is a little bit, this is serious, and it's very intriguing. I mean, it's almost like, you know, make a fucking movie about it, to be honest. But what was Jack's motivation? Was Jack's motivation that he wanted to, you know, he wants to go to heaven, or is it that he wants to, you know, be a rock star? Like, what's his motivation, man? You know?
I think Jack's motivation comes from a couple of different places. Number one, he is actually a devout Buddhist. He has been for as long as I've known him, which is about 15 years now, and for many years before that, I think basically for his whole life, he was brought up in a very devout Buddhist home, and his other religion is metal. And I mean, he's actually one of the original metal drummers in Taiwan, going back to the very first days of the metal scene here. And he's the guy. I mean, he's the drummer who has taught virtually every metal drummer in the entire metal scene to date. I mean, if you go down to his place in the Ximending neighborhood of Taipei, he's got a studio there called Jack's Studio. That's still where a lot of the guys who they want to drum in the heavy metal, extreme metal style, that's where they go to learn. So I think for him, like, he's always wanted to combine these two religions or these two main facets of his life. He wanted to take the Buddhist culture and the metal culture and try and find a way to bring them together. It was just always a matter of trying to find the right people to make this happen for him. So it's,
wow,
it's only,
what a dream.
Yeah, like, it's only really now. Obvious, yeah. Yeah, it's only now that he's been able to actually have this come true by finding the right people to make it happen.
It is astonishing, because it's bringing, you know, passion into focus. And I mean, if you're a devout person, I mean, I think that's the other thing is, I think it's really hard for Western people, or even, like, you know, some Eastern people involved in, well, I think for Judaic God people, let's say, in total, I think it's very hard for them to really understand that, because it is so different. Like, the worship practice, the understanding of why you are doing something, it's almost like it's perplexing, because the ideology is completely different, right? Like, it's just alien to each other. Like, a devout person who follows Jesus and a devout or Muhammad and a devout person that follows Buddha are, I mean, they're alien. Their psychology is even alien to each other, why they're doing it. So, I mean, maybe a Christian monk, let's say, might have a better idea of what you're talking about. But I mean, yeah, the two religions are just based off, I mean, they're just based off a different premise. So, I mean, that's what makes it so interesting. And I hope that people do check out Buddhism more, because when I stumbled upon it, I mean, it was just something that was so, I guess, psychologically liberating for myself as well, you know, coming from a Christian background. Now, you know, I don't know what religion I belong to. I'm more agnostic, maybe, or strong agnostic, but I'm not really sure. But Buddhism definitely was something interesting. So when I came across you guys, and when I got a chance to talk to you a little bit, and how you explained yourself about, hey, man, like, you know, like, this isn't, you know, how you're saying, like, yeah, we're actually doing mantras and we're actually casting out the evil spirits and all this stuff, I was just like what, you know what I mean? Like, I was like, this is like, I was just like, oh my god, this is amazing. So what's the projection, Joe? Okay, no, wait, I want to touch on something first. I want to touch back on your books for a second. Take me through the three books, and then we're going to talk about just the perspective of Dharma and you as a writer and where Dharma's headed. And then we'll wrap this up. But tell me about your three books first. I want to know about that.
It was just a murder mystery slash political thriller. It was just me kind of examining what a potential Chinese takeover of Taiwan might look like. It was my first book. It's okay. Now out of it was my first book. It's now out of print, and I'm probably going to leave it that way. I look back on it like a lot of people would probably look back on their first output. I'm not like embarrassed about it, but it's definitely not my best work. It's
okay.
It was second one was called it had a Chinese title. It was called Busan Busu, which means not three, not four. It's a term that older people here will use to describe people like punks or people who just don't fit in well with society. You know, like here, conformity plays a big role with a lot with people. Young people are taught not to rock the boat. They're taught to just fit in, to, you know, live kind of a very button down, take the safe road type of life. And this book was about a punk band in Taipei. And I wrote it based on, you know, the 10 years of experience I had playing in underground bands here and kind of formed characters that were composites of people that I met in the scene. Because all the time here that I was playing in bands, I was usually I was the only foreigner in the band. And I'm still basically like the only foreigner who plays in metal bands in all of Taiwan. I'm just the token foreigner out here. And
so that was...
That was the second one, and then the third one just came out just under a year ago in July of 2020. It's called Migrante, and one of the topics that I've followed and that I've reported on as I've worked as a journalist here are human rights issues as they pertain to Southeast Asian migrant workers in Taiwan who unfortunately undergo a lot of exploitation. They're taken advantage of financially. There's a lot of abuse. There's just a lot of problems. And it's a very corrupt system that governs them. And so I took all of the reporting that I had done over a number of years, and I put that into a work of fiction based entirely in reality. And it's the story of a migrant fisherman from the Philippines who comes to Taiwan and is exposed to all of these problems within the migrant worker labor system here. And I used that book to raise awareness for this issue and also to raise money for advocacy groups who are trying to help migrant workers gain equal footing in Taiwan.
Wow, man. So what, like, I mean, you're in a band with Taiwanese guys, right? And you're amongst Taiwanese people all the time. How do they, like, do they feel... how do people feel about your book? How did Taiwanese people react to your book?
Because my books are in English up until this point, mostly people, they don't really talk about it. I'm sure not a lot of them have actually read my books. So, I mean, they just kind of say, oh, cool, you wrote a book. That's great. Yeah. This latest one, Migrante, is going to be released by a major publisher here actually next year in Mandarin. So I'm hoping that leads to more discussion about it, because I think it's important for local people here to read it, because it's a very it's an issue that doesn't get a lot of attention in the media here. It's something that's kind of swept under the rug. So again, I'm hoping it raises further awareness, and you know, with it being published in Mandarin in the local language, I'm hoping it has a broader impact. And
how do your bandmates feel about it? Like, how do the people closely associated in your life that belong, that are, you know, native to the country, how do they feel about this?
In the metal scene, in general here is quite progressive and inclusive, I would say, in general. So the vast majority of people, they don't harbor racist tendencies. They don't harbor bigoted tendencies towards people of color, towards you know, LGBTQ people or things of that nature. Most of the people in Taiwan, I would say, are open to discussion about how we can make things more inclusive, how we can make things better for minorities. So thus far in speaking with people who are involved in metal and punk here, if we're talking about these things, they want to know how things can change for the better, how they can help these people. I'm not going to say that's true of every metalhead or punk in Taiwan, because I haven't spoken to literally all of them, but definitely on the whole, over the course of my 15 years here, I would say it's a very progressive, inclusive sort of scene.
I just want to touch on this a little bit. I don't want to take up, you know, like a bunch of energy of the interview on this, but it is interesting because, I mean, it's like social media is, I mean, absolutely chaotic with, you know, two sides of a coin, whether you're far left or far right or, you know, somewhere in between kind of thing. It's like almost one of the only reasons why people use social media these days is to fight with people sometimes. In your, like, I mean, this sounds like this is a social cause, you know, like this is for the benefit of, say, people who need a voice or need some kind of representation, maybe. Is there already awareness about this? Are there groups in Taiwan canvassing for a change? Are most Taiwanese aware how badly people get treated to begin with? And is this something that, like, how far along is this? Because, I mean, it took hundreds of years for the West to wake up about, let's say, even slavery. And, I mean, even in Canada today, we still got social issues with the, you know, with the original people of Canada. And there's just, it's such a mess, you know, like, it is such a mess. And it sounds like Taiwan is, like, still in the mess. You know what I mean? Like, they're still creating the future mess. Because what happens, like, if this ever gets solved? Like, then you got to start talking about reparations and all the other stuff. So, but let's talk just right now. Like, is there a movement for the migrant workers? Are you at the frontier of a movement?
I would say it's the early days of a movement. There are groups here who have been fighting for years already. There's advocacy groups. There's organizations like the ones that I mentioned, like the Ilan Fishermen's Union, Serve the People Association. There's a group here in Taipei called 140. There's actually a large group of small organizations who have banded together, and they are spreading awareness. They stage protests. They stage events to build awareness for the issue. They stage events where they encourage Taiwanese people to interact with people from Southeast Asia who live here, because there are over 700,000 people from Indonesia, Vietnam, and the Philippines who are here working in factories, working as in-home caregivers, and working in the fishing industry here. So it's a lot. If you take 700,000,
I really didn't know that. That's not thing, a small amount of people. Like,
no, it's not a small amount of people, but many of them live very much out of sight, out of mind. Like the fishermen, they're always on the boats. They're always out on the sea. The factory workers, they're either in the factory or they live in company dorms, which are kept completely separate from the rest of society. And the in-home caregivers, they work in the home. So you only ever see them when they're out pushing grandma or grandpa around in a wheelchair at the park.
Wow.
Otherwise you don't see them. So it's very much still kind of under the table. People don't know how little they get paid. They don't know how the labor brokerage system rips them off with all kinds of fees, dubious fees that are charged for things that they don't need, or charged for services that they either don't get or don't require. But awareness is being built. And especially now, due to the coronavirus outbreak, which migrant workers were scapegoated for, they were blamed for spreading it. And it was spreading among migrant workers, but the reason it was spreading among them was because a lot of factory workers, they live in very crowded, overcrowded dorms. They're living in small rooms, 12 people to a room. So of course, if they're crammed in like that, of course the disease is going to spread among them quickly. Because they've been given no protection. It's not their fault. They're not going out and behaving irresponsibly. And fortunately, a lot of reports in the media, and I also wrote about it myself, showed the hypocrisy of this, of blaming people for getting sick when you're putting them in conditions that are conducive to them getting sick. So it's still early days as far as a movement is concerned, but it is something that Taiwan is going to have to take more seriously going forward, because Taiwan is on the verge of becoming a super-aged society. By 2025, this country is going to be super-aged. One in five people in the population is going to be over 65. Is it 60 or 65? I can't remember, but it's going to be an elderly population, and we're going to need more people from these countries to come here and to work to take care of the elderly, or just to take jobs in general in the factories.
Well, I think you're talking about something huge. And I think as Canadians, we can identify with this, because like a lot of Canadians, you know, in the, say, early 90s or whatever, they didn't understand why Canada was reaching for so many immigrants to move over to Canada. And it was like, hey, guys, like, you're not going to live forever, you know? And
yeah,
the only way a government can really raise its, you know, its GDP and the quality of life and everything is by having more people, having more jobs, paying more taxes, you know? So,
yeah.
I mean, that's just, you know, but people have to kind of step back to actually see that, you know, where it's like, hey, you know, they're taking our jobs or whatever, you know? But I'm not, you know, in these interviews, I kind of, and I'll just say it, like when I do these podcasts, I know basically almost all the people that I talk to, or, you know, only very few, I'm just getting to know them in the podcast. So I do a little bit of acting where I, you know, I pretend I don't know anything so that people can talk outright about the information I want people to know about them, you know? But the truth is, when it comes to this migrant problem, like, I do know about it. I am living in Taiwan, and I have come across people that are involved in it, that are directly affected by it. And it's not something that's on a billboard here. Like, you don't know about it unless you actually interact with it. And that's something that scared me a bit. You know, I'm going to be really honest. It kind of freaked me out that, you know, I peered into that world because I heard about your book, really. I mean, like, I was like, migrant worker, what is this? And I actually taught, you know, I asked you about it, and I asked some people or whatever. And the more I dove into it, I was like, oh my God, like, something really is happening here. And because if I'm out and about in Taipei or Kaohsiung or Taichung or Taiching or whatever, you don't hear about it. Like, no one's talking about it. Like, no one's like, oh yeah, man, this is so bad. Or people aren't posting on, you know, social media like, oh, like, you know, what's happening with these people? Why aren't people caring about them? It was you doing that. And that's how I, so yeah, it's a secret, man. You know, it's kind of a, well, like you said, it's totally swept under the rug. And the only way you see it is if it gets put in your face. And that's kind of scary. That's kind of a scary thing to talk about. Yeah, man, I just think you're doing something that's significant. And like, whether or not, I mean, like, I just want to tie it in because it is something that's for the benefit of humanity. It's the benefit of people. And it sounds something like a Buddhist would do, to be honest. You know, like, I mean, it kind of sounds like, you know, it's like, it's ethical campaigning, you know, it's based on morality. I mean, you're actually raising money for people. You're supporting the change that people have to change the way they think, and they do, because when you treat someone unfairly, like, you have to get out of that mindset, you know. And it is shocking. It's a bit shocking. So traveling back into, like, going into the band itself, like, have you been a person that's often looked at situations like, in, you know, you've done journalism, but you were doing music journalism, and you wrote books, and it's fascinating. Your first book was like, what if China did take over Taiwan? Cause I mean, now even Ben Shapiro's talking about it, you know? And you know, the second book being the punk scene. So that's super interesting too, because like you said, you combine people's real characters into characters and kind of played like a version of Sims of it, I guess you would say, kind of thing. And that, you know, so that's like really psychological too, to peer inside of a foreign country, of the operation of a, you know, the social drama of a foreign country. I think that's fascinating. And then with this migrant worker thing, this sounds like it sounds ultra righteous. Like it sounds like such a righteous thing to take on. And I mean, you must, the fact that you've got a major publisher and they're going to turn it into Chinese in a Chinese speaking country, you must feel very proud about that. And I mean, your band isn't exactly slouching either. You just released your EP. You're playing big shows in Taiwan. I'm watching you guys before the pandemic was here, you're playing big shows. Where's all this headed? Like, do the guys find what you're doing with the migrant worker? Are they inspired by that? Do you guys talk about maybe, you know, doing benefit shows, or does that have anything to do with your dharma?
No, it does. It absolutely does. And actually, with the band, in a way, every show that we play and everything that we do kind of is a benefit, because we actually take everything that we make, and there are six people in the band. So if we actually do make some money off of something, we would split it six ways. We actually divide it seven ways, and we take an equal share and we donate it to a specific charitable organization. Wow. Here. So we've donated to pandemic response for shows. Wow. In the past. And we just look at what's happening in Taiwan, and wherever we might see a need, that's where we send the money. And it's, so, you know, this is
social con, like, I gotta, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, but where's the social consciousness coming from? Like, you guys are like, this isn't normal. You know what I mean? Like, I know, like, most bands are so like, it's not, because most people are doing a music career that's completely self-involved. Like, they want to be famous. They want to get chicks. I mean, even if it's, women doing music or whatever, they want nice jewelry. They want a nice house. They want to, you know, they want to be famous. They want to be popular. And I mean, and let's just get rid of gender, because I don't want to get attacked about that. But people just generally want things for themselves. They want to be popular. They want to be famous. They want to have money. What is up with your guys' whole social cause here? Because you're kind of doing this in a very inverted way, right? Like, you're like getting out there and doing things for the benefit of the people listening, for the benefit of the people that are less than. So what's up with that? Like, are you guys just a bunch of monks, or what are you doing here?
We're definitely not monks. I think it has to do with a few different factors. I mean, number one, all of us in the band, we're all like in our mid 30s and up. So we're all a little bit older. Most of us are either married or in long-term relationship. So the whole thing about, you know,
but just wait, this isn't Greenpeace. You're not like,
no,
doing some, yeah, ambiguous, like, oh yeah, let's do Greenpeace, guys. Like, I mean, you guys are seriously doing something super special. What's the conscientiousness about this? Like, what the hell is going on with you guys? Like, are you like, hey, let's make a, go ahead, please. Sorry.
Yeah. We want to do something that's about the music, but that's bigger than the music. I mean, meaningful. If you talk about creating,
it's so meaningful.
Yeah,
right? Like,
something that's meaningful to us personally, that's beyond just getting up on stage and entertaining people, which of course is the number one goal. We want people to come to our shows, forget their problems, have a good time, and leave happier and better off than when they walked in. That's the number one goal. But if we can actually use the music to do good in the community as well at the same time, then that's just a bonus. And none of us are doing this for a job. I mean, we do see something from it, but it's not our main vocation. Not to say that we would ever not be open to that, but we all have our careers where we say that we can make our money, and we're all fortunate enough to have jobs that are stable. We're able to make a living, so we don't have to rely on music in order to do that. So that allows us in turn to say, okay, we'll give away a portion of what we make to various charitable causes. But it's about doing something meaningful beyond just making an album or playing some shows. And we want to do this long term. We want to grow it. We want to raise people's awareness for various causes as well, and use the platform that we have so far in order to just help people, basically. So we want to create something bigger than the music, basically.
Well, I mean, it certainly sounds like it, because I mean, it sounds like the music is kind of like it's the reason to gather, let's say, right? Like it's the platform for people to gather, and the things that you're doing for other people is the benefit of it, right? So, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, I'll tell you something, like, you know, I'm doing these podcasts with these big companies, and the artists that I've been doing have been quite big too. I did an artist in Taiwan, 2 million followers, and the ones in India have millions, like, you know, millions of hits, and, you know, and the ones in Sweden, even like 100,000 followers on their pages and stuff. But I really wanted to talk to you, Joe, because what you're doing, like, it's so significant that I think I knew it would be such an interesting conversation. And I mean, that's what really matters to me too. Like when I'm talking to people, I'm just really trying to dig out, you know, like, you know, what the fuck is going on, or what, you know, why is this important? You know what I mean? And I think what you're doing is ultra important. And I think it also can lead to, I don't know, just, it can just go so far. It can go so far in so many places. And it just needs to catch that wave. It just needs to catch that fire, because I think, like, the way you guys are organizing yourselves, this could exist in so many places, because it's for the right reasons, and it's just good. You know, like, I just look at this and I'm touched, excuse me, I'm emotionally kind of taken by it, because it is righteous and it is good. And I'm proud to know you, and I'm happy for you that you're finding success in it. And honest to God, like, you know, I feel, it makes me feel like I need to do something about things that I, you know, that I believe in, and push something for a better change. And it does make me feel motivated to try to find people like-minded to try to do something for people in the world, or people in the area, or something. You know, it motivates me to do good, because yeah, it's rock and roll, it's fucking cool, and yeah, it's like, oh yeah, published author, how cool is that? But I mean, everything behind it is soulful and it's meaningful, and I just swear to God, it just doesn't, you don't come across this every day. I mean, it's Gwar, it's like Gwar meets Buddha, you know, and how fucking weird is that. You know, you guys, I mean, I don't know. It's not even that. It's not even gourmet. I don't know what it is. It's just something new. It's something new. And it's something I think in its approach, in its idea, in its ideology, it's something I think people have to think about. It's something people have to think about their career as well. Like, do something meaningful, you know, do something that matters to you, not, yeah, it's meaningful to play guitar. Yeah, it's meaningful to sing about romance. But what about other people? You know, what about all of us? What about common good? You know, and that's, sorry, I'm just ranting now, but I really, that's what I'm getting out of this. And that's what makes it so different. So it almost becomes religious in itself, because it is the entertainment business, but it is something to attach to for the heights of morality. You know, and I think you're really at the ethos of something extraordinarily ethical and moral while still being fucking cool, you know? So
that's the goal. I mean, we're just trying to get people to think for themselves, you know, do what you want to do in this life. But just remember, we're only here for a limited amount of time. We're only here for so long, and do what you can while you can, basically, would be our main message. If there is any central message at all, you know, like, all of us who are in the band, especially myself, we all have a certain amount of privilege. Let's use that privilege. Let's use that platform, not just to enrich ourselves, which we do. Of course we get something out of this band.
Of course. Yeah. You know, I mean, of course, but I mean,
anytime. Yeah.
It's just
anytime you step up on,
you're constructing a better, you're giving people the opportunity to be better. That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah. Like, you're giving people the opportunity to say, okay, it's in your hands. What are you going to do with it? You know, it's not like, hey, we're not going to the show to, you know, smoke joints and get blasted with beer, but maybe you are, but you can still, if you actually care about the band and you investigate anything in the band, hey, you're in for a surprise. Like, you're going to be like, what? You know, because it is going to affect you and it is going to make you think, and it is going to be like, what the fuck are these guys really up to? You know, because this is, it's on a different level. It's on a different level, you know? But in saying all this, let's wrap up here. What's Dharma up to now? So you just released an EP. What are the plans? Like, how far in the future can you look ahead and tell me what you're up to?
Yeah, we just released the EP last week. It's on all the digital platforms. It's called Bhai Saajha Guru.
Hey, but what's the date right now? It's like July 7th.
We're sitting at July 7th. Now it's July 7th.
2021. Yeah. This was your first EP, yeah?
Yeah.
What was the release date you released on digital?
I think that was the 29th of June that came out. So that's out now. 3-song EP. Later in the year, we're going to have our first full-length album. We've got a whole bunch of songs already recorded. Now we're just going to meet out the releases a little bit. We're going to have a full-length album by the end of the year at the latest. And then following that, we've got another EP planned. And then as soon as we can get back into shows again, because, you know, we're under these level 3 restrictions in Taiwan currently. We had a whole bunch of festivals lined up for the rest of the summer, as we had been doing through the spring, but those are all either canceled outright or postponed. We'll get those scheduled back again. We're invited back to Luckfest again in Tainan in the fall, which was, you know, you and I met down there as well.
Yeah.
And then after that, we're just hoping to get out and play and tour and, you know, promote the releases. Spread the message, go as far and wide as we possibly can. We want to get over
any
Europe.
Any specific countries you're looking at right now? Any countries that really have your attention of saying, yeah, I'd like to be, you know, I'd like Dharma to happen here. Any places in particular?
For me personally, I mean, we do have a booking agent now who wants to help us out and get us over to Europe. I'd love to get back over there and, you know, spread this around there and see how it plays to European audience. You know, like
no doubt, man.
The most metal countries in the world. You know, Scandinavia, Northern Europe, all through Germany, everywhere. I just want to get out and play. I mean, I'll go anywhere that'll have us. I'm ready to go, and you know, I'm ready to get out of this pandemic, get my vaccine, and just go and get out and play. So. We'll get the music out there over the next few months. Like I said, full-length album by the end of the year, then another EP. Hopefully the response is good. And if it is, wherever people have us, we'll go.
Well, I'd love for you guys to even attend Live at Heart in Sweden in 2022. We're going to have 3 conferences. We're going to have touring between the conferences and schools, actually. And like, this is what we're aligning. And that could even be a landing date for you guys, because we... Live at Heart in Sweden, we do actually do work with the government here, with the Minister of Culture. So if that helps at all, any sort of way, I'd love to have you guys. You're absolutely invited. You know, if that can help in any sort of way to land you in Europe, I would absolutely love you guys to be showcasing at our conference. And I wish you all the best in the future. And, you know, thanks so much for spending, you know, this hour plus with me today to talk about your journal, you know, your writing, your authorship work, you know, both in journalism and also as a published book writer, but also, you know, the band and the philosophy and everything behind it. Just really eye-opening stuff, man. And I wish you all the best, 100%.
No, it's my pleasure, man. Thanks a lot for having me. And yeah, I mean, if you'll have us over in Sweden, we'll come to Sweden.
All right. Well, we'll talk about that separately, but again, thanks a lot, Joe, and take care of yourself, all right?
Thanks, Evan. Take care.